Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us. Hands up, please don't shoot me. That song rang out in a really sing-song refrain as protesters were demonstrating in Portland last month. They call themselves the Wall of Moms, women who came out in support of Black Lives Matter demonstrations. They locked arms and put their bodies between federal agents and the protesters. This is not the first time in American history that we've seen mothers as activists. Our guest is here to take us through that history and explain why it's often effective. Kelly Wills is an associate professor of communication at UW-Stevens Point. She teaches courses on women and gender studies, modern activism, and the Me Too movement. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We already acknowledged that there is a history lesson inherent in this conversation. How and really why have mothers organized in social movements?
So we've seen a really long history of this. In terms of mothers engaging in political and social activism, we saw this in the temperance movement and the suffrage movement, even the history of Mother's Day, which actually originated amongst anti-war protesters. And then we have more contemporary movements such as Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the Million Mom March, Moms Demand Action, which was created after Sandy Hook, and really a lot of others too. We've also seen, though, mothers themselves and even the identity of motherhood being co-opted for other types of political purposes. And so in 2004, for example, both George W. Bush and John Kerry campaigns, they claimed these various mothers groups as supporters. However, on the websites, Moms for Kerry and Security Moms for Bush actually raised some doubts as to the origins, since neither actually listed any individual people or individual mothers as founders. And so it's interesting to see why politicians use motherhood and the trope of motherhood to give themselves sort of political credence. We've also seen a really rich history of how white motherhood specifically has been used as a cover for inciting and reinforcing some really racist policies in terms of like white flight and school segregation. Elizabeth Gillespie McRae has this great book called Mothers of Massive Resistance, where she discusses how white women have used the term mother historically to justify racial segregation and Jim Crow laws. And then we see this really interesting trope of motherhood used by men and other politicians when they are called out for sexism. For example, for when they resort to using their wives or their daughters as sort of evidence of their virtue. So we just saw this recently with Ted Yoho calling Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez an effing B word, and then later apologizing for that by mentioning that he has a wife and two daughters, as if that was some sort of justification for how he was actually an ally to women. And we've seen a lot of these types of critiques before as well, right? Men stating that because they have wives or daughters, they're in fact real allies to women, and how like problematic that can be, because one, you know, it shouldn't take having a wife or daughter to see women as deserving or compassionate of our care, but also women shouldn't have to be determined as, you know, only as in respect to their relationship to men's lives. So a long, rich history in terms of how mothers have been involved in activism, but also how we use motherhood in different types of political ways, too.
Yeah. Let's go to Portland then and talk specifically about the Wall of Moms. How did that change the narrative about Black Lives Matter demonstrations there?
So if we look at the coverage of the Wall of Moms, it was not until white women were getting tear gassed that the story actually got picked up. I think it's really important to know that Black mothers have been protesting for more than 50 days before the Wall of Moms story was even noticed, right? And so what's fascinating was how those protesters, we saw moms, dads, and vets, specifically put to the forefront these valued identities to sort of rehumanize themselves and challenge the idea that Black Lives Matter protesters were just anarchists, right? Or Antifa or terrorists. I mean, it's definitely harder to justify tear gassing protesters when they are white mothers singing lullabies versus those other really narrow stereotypes. And so I think the effective power of mothers groups, you know, singing lullabies and standing before the police themselves really relies on this history, though, of white innocence and the sanctity of white motherhood as that driving force.
Yeah, because Black mothers, they've always been activists because they're constantly fighting against racism. They're constantly having to advocate for their families, whether you see them in bright yellow shirts on the picket lines or not.
Right. I mean, if I get pulled over by the police as a white woman, I don't have to fear for my life. Right. So it's a luxury for me to have not been able to have to be involved in activism until maybe later in my 20s or 30s, because a specific issue really rallied, you know, and wanted and had me think about that option. But for a lot of Black moms, they don't have the luxury of not being involved in different movements because of again, their existence and what they have to face every single day.
Yeah. Why do politicians or groups, organizations or causes, why do they bring moms in as part of it, of their identities? I mean, I guess it works. Why?
I think as part of it, this is the humanizing aspect, right? So again, we have, you know, Mother's Day, and we tend to, as a society, say, you know, mothers are the hard, it's the hardest job in the world, right? But again, we don't actually have policies to support that. And so I think it definitely, in terms of, and again, it's a specific type of motherhood too, so we should be really clear. So, you know, again, mothers can potentially lend credence to political activism due to the ways in which we societally valorize mothers, but only certain mothers, right? So single moms, fat mothers, LGBTQ mothers, Black mothers do not get that same level of reverence from mainstream institutions as attractive, white, straight moms, right? And so again, if it's the quote unquote right type of motherhood, that can add value to a political campaign because it humanizes it and because it shows that there's, you know, this demographic of people who are supporting them that we as a society value. And so that's kind of how that works.
We're talking with Kelly Wills, who is a UW Stevens Point professor who teaches courses that explore modern activism, women, gender studies, the Me Too movement. And you can join our conversation now by calling 800-642-1234. Did you notice the wall of moms? Did it get your attention? Maybe you remember your mom being politically active, or maybe you specifically remember her not being politically active. How are you as a mother? Give us a call, share your story at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org as we explore this idea of mothers and politics and specifically how we see them being politically active. And Kelly, some members of Moms Demand Action and Mothers Against Drunk Driving, they really found themselves called to activism when something terrible happened to their own families. How is that different than for non-white mothers?
Again, I think it's that luxury of being able to be ignorant of the world around you until it actually affects you, right? So, you know, Moms Demand Action, Newtown, right? Sandy Hook, right? Not being able to be called to action because of the different privileges you have of being a white person in the United States, right? And so, again, we see various white mothers being called when, like you said, when a tragedy happens, but we see Black women organizing, you know, since early childhood because of the everyday types of oppression that exist for non-white women.
So it really is that for many white mothers, there's a catalyst that prompts them right to step up and speak up in a way that for non-white women, it's just part of their existence.
I think that's true. Yeah.
And how have we seen mothers in the past mobilize around their motherly identities for policies that, well, we now know are wrong?
So if we look at sort of the history of white motherhood, but there's a long history of them marrying their gender roles to devoted to racial segregation. So in the 1920s, for example, a lot of white mothers would police the areas where public and private life sort of intersected. So we had midwives classify the race of babies they delivered. We had public school teachers actually taking students who were suspected of being mixed race out of their classrooms. And they invoked their identity as mothers to elevate their supposedly moral opposition to integration and really distinguish themselves from open bigotry, right? But again, they played a really large part in terms of segregation, in terms of Jim Crow laws. Some of them even used baby strollers to block buses that were meant to take children to integrated schools. And so that's a history that we tend to not really be aware of. That's not really taught in our public schools, but that was really part of that time.
Because we act like when moms stand up to defend their families, that's inherently moral or ethical. But really, sometimes when moms have stood up to defend their families, it's been wrong.
Right. I mean, it's the essentialist argument that just by having a woman do X, Y, and Z, it's going to be better, right? We've seen women governors roll back, you know, abortion rights and everything for other women. And so just by putting an identity into a place of representation doesn't mean that it's going to be better for the people who are part of that demographic, right? It's not that inherently on and off switch. And so again, we need to make sure that we're not just conflating womanhood with being better. I mean, that's sort of benevolent sexism, right? The idea that women are more morally better than men, right? So therefore, if they were in power, things would be better. It's not to say that representation doesn't matter and that women leaders haven't shown to be incredible leaders, but it's because many of them have to multitask and many of them are mothers and have to do 10,000 things at once. And so it's those types of history and also oppression that sometimes it makes them strong leaders in different types of arenas. Hmm.
Kelly Wills is a UW Stevens Point professor who teaches courses exploring modern activism and women and gender studies. And she's here with us as we explore the role that mothers play in social movements. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What impact has it had for you to see specifically mothers being active or demonstrating? Maybe you are a mom or you consider yourself a mom and you participate in social movements and demonstrations. What inspired you to take that step? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Your experiences, your questions are welcome here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us as we continue this conversation on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with UW Stevens Point Professor Kelly Wills about how we view motherhood in America, specifically how the identity of mom can change the narrative of a political movement. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Are you involved with Moms Demand Action or Mothers Against Drunk Driving? How do you view organizations that are fronted, run by moms? And how do you think this squares with the policies that our country has in place to support mothers, or maybe the lack of them? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, and we'll bring you into the conversation here. Kelly, as we talk about the wall of moms in Portland and privilege and differences and racism, to some extent, the wall of moms were recognizing their privilege, really putting themselves between the protesters and the federal agents sent to Portland. Where does that acknowledgement of power and then the use of it fit into the history of motherhood and activism?
I mean, I think we really need to be like, it is a good thing that white mothers are putting their bodies on the line for Black Lives Matter. Like, let's be really clear about that. I don't want to be, you know, obviously we're talking about, you know, different types of critiques and nuances here. But that's a markedly good thing. And so I think, you know, when there's a rich history of sort of, women's movements, even in the 1960s, wanting their movement to be taken seriously and leaving out members of different groups, right? So we had with Betty Friedan in the 1960s, she was not a fan of having lesbians in the movement. She called them the Lavender Menace, right? So there is a history of feminists wanting their movement to be taken seriously and in doing so, alienating and really oppressing people who weren't white, straight in these privileged categories, right? And so it's important that I think in this moment, white moms are trying to shift that power in this specific instance and allow Black mothers to lead, but also put their lives on the line, recognizing their privilege. And so that's a difference that we haven't seen before in terms of putting their lives and their bodies ahead of these other groups who have been historically marginalized.
We've got Logan from Green Bay on the line who wants to join the conversation. Hi, Logan.
Hi. Thanks, man. What I wanted to tell you, for thousands of years, people believe that the mother was a stabilizing influence, and because of her maternal instinct, she would make the right choice. I myself, whenever I had a problem, I went to my mother and not to my father. And many stories have the theme that women are compassionate and they would make a choice that is acceptable.
Logan, thanks for sharing that perspective about people seeing women as the stabilizing link of the family, the emotional strength. And really, when women step up in these situations, Kelly, that's one of the things that they bring up, that they have emotional strength and they see themselves as a force, right?
Yeah, I mean, even if you look back at Sarah Palin and, you know, the pit bull mothers, right, and the mama bears, right, and we saw a lot of Republican women identifying with that identity as well, and saying, like, I'm like that, right, and I'm going to fight for my kids, right, and do all these types of things. And so that has been sort of a trope of strength as well, these mama bear sort of identities, in terms of not only morals, but being able to fight for their children and fight for their families as well.
And when we do use those tropes, I mean, I'm a mom. I feel like I'm strong. So that is a thing. And yet, I don't, I'm just putting that out there. But also, I don't want to abuse that. I don't want to leverage it in the wrong way. But if there's a way to leverage it for social justice, then should we? I mean, I just keep going in circles here, Kelly.
It's so complicated, right? I mean, again, if you want to be part of, I mean, again, white mothers have not always been part of the Black Lives Matter movement, right? Let's just be clear about that. And so recognizing that a movement that might be new to you, I think as long as you're within that movement and shifting your power and allowing your power and allowing your voice to be taken by others who have been historically marginalized and putting your life on the line, I think as long as you're listening to leaders of that movement and asking, you know, again, respecting what they're asking for and what they need, like that's really a good place to think about how to do allyship, right? So shifting power, listening a lot more than speaking, and realizing that you may have some ideas, but these people have been at it for a really long time, and to, again, take a cue from what they're trying to sort of advocate for what's best for the movement.
Kelly Wills is an associate professor of communication at UW Stevens Point, and we're talking about the role of women and gender in activism. And you can join our conversation. There's still time at 800-642-1234. Pat in Madison is ready. Good afternoon, Pat.
Yes. I was very fortunate. I had a mother that was very active in civil rights and in politics when I grew up in Milwaukee in the 50s and 60s. She was the chair of the Democratic Party, ran JFK's campaign, was a newspaper reporter that covered the White House, and she fought for civil rights zoning changes in Milwaukee. And unfortunately, it came at a high personal cost. She suffered a lot of abuse from a lot of people for being a very active mother. But she caused a great deal of civil change in the city of Milwaukee and the city of Wauwatosa, where she grew up, and did a lot of great causes. She helped get JFK elected. So that caused a lot of us as children. She had seven children at the same time. And one of my brothers is the mayor of Wisconsin City. My sister has written books on the women's suffragette movement. And many of us are very politically active. So I think strong women are great role models for young children.
Pat, thank you for bringing that up and sharing the story about your mom. And also, Kelly, what I hear there among all of Pat's mom's accomplishments was, and Pat's mom had seven children, and she got some guff for being active.
Yeah. And again, that's really rare. I look at the 1960s, there were a lot of women who wanted to be part of the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, but the men in charge wouldn't shift their power, right? And so they were able and ready to be on the front lines and working with these different groups. And that's sort of how the women's movement started, was, you know, it was these disaffected women who couldn't, you know, be in the same room and have the microphone, right, or be able to lead movements. And so that's great that his mom was actually able to do that. And again, we saw even in the 1960s as well, we'd have, you know, heterosexual couples go home from the protest and the wife would be expected to make dinner afterwards, right? I mean, so again, having to be on the front lines and also take care of the family and home. And we see some of that has not shifted today, right? We think that we've gotten so far in terms of 2020, but this pandemic has shown that we are not as far as we need to be in terms of that division of labor.
Well, so then, in what ways do these American values and our American policies then contradict when we're talking about respect for mothers?
I mean, I think the pandemic has shown how behind we are, right? There's this great piece in The New Yorker right now that came out discussing how in this gendered economy, women are these perpetual debtors. So our society can refuse to provide essential services by compelling women to offer those services for free. So in the absence of schools, we see women across the socioeconomic spectrum, they've just sacrificed their work to tend to these homebound children. We see business women are turning down new clients. Women in higher ed or who are academics have just stopped writing. Working class women with no one to watch their kids can't leave home at all. And so, again, we think we've made all this progress, but without institutional policy changes and really cultural changes too. I mean, again, we still have movies like Daddy Daycare that, you know, it frames men as incapable of fathering, right? All of these examples, just, you know, if you see a man in a cleaning commercial, it's because he put the red shirt with the whites and everything's pink now, right? And so this, like, this learned helplessness. I have a friend who just said, it's just easier for me to put the kids to bed because he can't do it, right? And so we're reinforcing this idea that men just aren't good at fathering and taking care of the kids. And if that's still happening every day right now in the pandemic, women are going to fall behind 30 years. Right? I mean, again, we are just, we don't have these policies in terms of caregiving to support women who are existing in the pandemic right now.
And as we wrap up this conversation, I just want to welcome Jaden from Cornell to share those thoughts. Jaden, welcome.
Hi. I was just calling to see if you can maybe talk a little bit more about shifting power as an ally when you are like a, you know, trying to support a group that doesn't necessarily have a voice and you come from a place of privilege.
Thanks for the question, Jaden. Kelly got about a minute here.
Yeah. So, I mean, oftentimes, even in groups, I just find myself, do I actually need to speak right now? Right. And so it's just sort of like, you know, this weight idea that, you know, as a white person, my voice is valuable. And especially for white men, they are taught from birth that their opinions are valuable, that their voices are valuable. And so if you are a white male ally in a group, one of the best things you can do is just be quiet and listen to other organizers and other activists in terms of trying to have an opinion and trying to be the center of attention and trying to have all the ideas, right? And just really take a breath and see how much power there is in listening.
Right. It doesn't mean that your ideas aren't valued. It's just other people's
right.
are too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Kelly, thank you so much for breaking this down for us today.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Wills is an associate professor of communication at UW Stevens Point. She spoke with us about the recent Wall of Moms protests in Portland and the history of mothers participating in political activism. Coming up, college sports was upended this week with the announcement of two major conferences postponing fall competitions because of the coronavirus. We're discussing the divisions and the implications surrounding the moves for teams and money for parents and college athletes. Stay with us here. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network, it's an hour for you. We're taking your ideas for programs and topics, and we revisit some of our political conversations from this summer. Join in with your perspective on the morning show. It's live from 6 until 9, bright and early tomorrow. Now, in college towns around the Midwest and West Coast, stadiums will be silent, playing fields will be empty. The Big Ten and Pac-12, two of the nation's largest college football and sports conferences, made it official that they would be postponing, if not canceling, fall competitions. The Big 12, SEC, the Southeastern Conference, and the ACC, or Atlantic Coast Conference, so far are planning to go forward with their seasons. The effects of these decisions have and continue to reverberate among fans and coaches and athletes and their parents and also politicians. And to discuss this and how it looks going forward for winter and spring sports, even beyond, our guest is Karen Weaver. She's currently assistant clinical professor in the LeBeau College of Business at Drexel University, though next month she's joining the faculty at the Graduate School at the University of Pennsylvania. Karen has been a Division I and III national championship head coach and director of athletics. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, great to be with you.
We won't dance around it. You wrote in a recent piece for Forbes after the Big Ten made its decision about the season, you know, final earlier this week. You wrote, "It's about damn time." So remind us what pushed you to this point.
Well, I think I wrote the article because I really wanted to take a look at the leadership gaffes that I thought that folks just really missed the windows, missed the moment, if you will, from the month of May on. And I actually quoted the five stages of denial for grief. And I talked about denial, and I talked about bargaining, and I talked about finally getting to acceptance with the idea. And I feel like that's the exact stages that college athletics leaders, presidents, conference commissioners finally said, you know, we just have to accept this is our reality.
Okay, so was it denial, though, or was it hope and optimism that we would somehow figure out how to pull this off?
Both. It was absolutely both, because coaches, and having been one and been an athletics director, we are eternally optimistic people. We believe with just a little bit more hard work, a little bit more focus, a little bit more commitment, we can get anything done. And it is a wildly great attribute to have, except in the middle of a pandemic with a virus you don't understand.
So how do you think colleges, conferences, even the NCAA could have handled it differently instead of the denial and optimism combo?
I really think that we missed the opportunity back in May to start seriously thinking about what plan B would be if we couldn't have football. Everything that I read, every person that I talked to who was in that sphere was only operating on the moment-to-moment idea that we would start small, we would bring the athletes back in small pods, we would keep them socially distanced. If we had any athletes that tested positive, we would immediately quarantine them. But then beyond that, they didn't really have a plan for when they had massive outbreaks. And we saw that a lot in the Big Ten. Rutgers had a massive outbreak. And so all of a sudden you went from quarantining maybe one or two players to 25 or 30 players. And there wasn't a plan for that. And in the middle of all of that, one of the things that I thought was, it almost felt like the train had gotten going down the tracks and there was no putting the brakes on it. I think that was a missed opportunity.
Now, there are differences among the conferences. The Big 12, the SEC, and the ACC say they don't see things the same way as the other two Big 2 conferences. And the commissioner of the SEC, Greg Sankey, was interviewed earlier this week on the Dan Patrick Show and talked about some of the protective measures that they're taking, which he says go beyond guidelines released by the NCAA. Let's take a listen.
We're looking at third-party testing opportunities so that we can have independence, common reporting, common testing. A lot of work to achieve that, but certainly a part of making football viable. And our medical advisory group has said, yes, we can continue to go forward. Were that advice to change, certainly would be a stopping point. But the indicators are we can right now do what we're doing in a healthy way, and we're going to continue to consider that central issue, health, as we move forward, we hope, towards competition with no assurances that that actually will take place.
I mean, Sankey's saying we're following the rules. So at what level here, Karen, does there need to be leadership that you think would be offering them some different decision-making choices there?
So this pandemic has really given us an opportunity to look at the way big time college sports works. And for many years now, we've argued that the Power Five conferences, of which those three conferences plus the Pac-12 and the Big Ten are a part of, have operated in lockstep with their goals and interests in mind to the detriment of the rest of Division One. And clearly in this situation, they are not. So one of the things that Commissioner Sankey said there was he was talking about testing results and testing data being made available to the other conference schools. The key indicator in all of this has been the ability to get testing results back in a timely fashion that makes a difference in the way you structure and plan your practices and your day. In the recent weeks, an average turnaround for a test that's not commanded by a doctor, you're not in a hospital and you need to have one right there, has been anywhere from 3 to 5 days. Some outliers have been longer. But we know that in the structure of a group organization like a football team, which is a large group, it's well over 150 people at practice. If it takes even one full day for somebody's results to come back, the possibility of infecting other people within that 100 or 200 athlete or coaching area goes up substantially. So the idea that we can do football without having a very quick, and when I say quick, like it results in 15 minutes to 60 minutes, the ability to pull somebody and isolate them out almost immediately from practice is a key indicator in all this. And I think that's where college football needs to get to, rather than trying to dance around some of the other issues that they've faced.
We're talking with Karen Weaver, who's an assistant clinical professor at Drexel University now. She's been a college athlete and a college coach, and we're talking about sports and students in this pandemic. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What are you thinking about as you see different conferences make different decisions? Maybe you are a college student, or you played college ball, or participated in a non-football sport in college. How are you thinking about the decisions that these conferences are making right now in a pandemic? 800-642-1234. Karen, we have to talk about the money. I mean, with football, even just football, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars. We've heard the University of Wisconsin-Madison throw around the number $100 million in lost revenue if they don't have a season this year. I mean, what are the financial stakes here? They're real.
They are very real, and they are huge. And it just goes to show you how much of the football revenue drives these conferences. March Madness can't come close to this kind of money. It, generally, I would say in these conferences, football revenue is about five times that of March Madness basketball money. You also add in the incredible investment that schools in the Big Ten and the Pac-12 have made recently in facility enhancements, and therefore taking on facility debt. And I took a quick look, and the top 15 schools in the country that have the most amount of athletics-related debt, the Big Ten holds five of those slots in the top 15. And looking at a school like your next-door neighbor, Minnesota, for example, they have a $262 million debt that's just related to building facilities, of which they've got to figure out between $16 and $20 million a year in order to pay that. So that is very much like trying to make sure you pay your mortgage every month, because that's a fixed cost that is not going away. And Michigan, for example, has almost $290 million in debt, of which they've got to fund almost $18 million a year. So this is not an insignificant part of this issue either.
How do we think about the financial situation, though, of other sports beyond football, non-revenue generating sports like field hockey?
Well, you're talking about a sport that goes after my heart, because I was a field hockey coach for a long time. This is a pretty tough place. I was thinking about this today. The field hockey practice in the Big Ten started Monday, and they probably had a really good day of practice on Monday. And then Tuesday, the announcement came out to the Big Ten that they were going to postpone their fall sports. I can't imagine what it would have been like to have been a head coach at that point in time, to have to turn and look at your athletes and say, our season's over with and we only played one day. Let's hope for the spring. And to be an athlete in that situation is incredibly difficult, because that's a key part of your identity. You know, you view yourself throughout your entire high school career as having the skills to move on to play at the highest level you can, which is in this country outside of the Olympics is Division I. So to have that taken away from you and not knowing the certainty of which you will play again is very, very unnerving.
Yeah. And those sports that don't necessarily generate most of the revenue, they still benefit from the revenue. So if the revenue isn't coming in, does that put those in jeopardy?
It does. You look at Stanford a few weeks ago, they had one of the largest, most successful, broad-based athletic programs in the country. They had 36 varsity sports. They consistently finished number one in the last 20 years in what's called the Director's Cup, which is the best broad-based, most successful athletics program in terms of winning percentage. They've turned out hundreds of Olympians over multiple decades. They dropped 11 sports in one day because they said, we can't sustain this anymore. And so if anything, that's a signal that athletic departments are looking at how broad can we really say we can afford, especially when all of this is tied up in facilities, in spending in football, in coaches' salaries, and then, of course, trying to figure out how to pay for everything else that goes into an athletic department.
Yeah. We're talking with Karen Weaver, and we're focusing on the state of college sports this fall amid this ongoing pandemic. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How are you thinking about the balance of not having much college sports to watch this fall with the precautions that need to be taken for the health and safety of players and coaches and their families? What do you think of the assessment of timing and whether conferences should all be on the same side here? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the postponement of college sports in the Big Ten and the Pac-12 and not in the other three major conferences. Our guest, Karen Weaver, has been a Division I and Division III national championship head coach, a director of athletics. As a college athlete, she was an All-American field hockey goalkeeper and member of the national training squad for the 1980 U.S. Olympic team. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you an athlete affected by this decision? We want to hear from you, offer your perspective. Maybe you're a parent or you know someone who is in college right now dealing with the athletic uncertainty. Join the conversation. Share with us at 800-642-1234. And we've got Scott from Oregon who is ready to talk with us. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. I have a couple questions for your guest. It seems like these decisions are being made at a level that's distant from some of the people that are closest to it. A lot of players talk about all the preparation they've done and how much they want to play. That's one. And two, a lot of coaches think that they'll be able to actually keep their environment safer for their student athletes if there's a season versus just canceling and letting those folks to their own devices. I'm just curious what Dr. Weaver might have to say about the voice of players and coaches in addition to some of the other populations that are making these decisions.
Thanks for the questions, Scott. Karen Weaver, what do you think about taking coaches and players' opinions into account when making these decisions to keep people safe?
Well, I think for too long we've left the players out of the conversation. And in fact, that has really become to the forefront with a number of issues. First, we've had the College Football Parents 24/7 group, which organized around the fact that they didn't know what was going on as far as taking care of their sons and whether their sons would be safe to come back to campus. So that was a group. That's a group of about 2,400 parents that have been worked together on a Facebook group, and they've been actively advocating to know more about the health and safety modifications that have been made to make sure their sons can return to campus in a safe way. There have been activist groups within the conferences. So the Big Ten and the Pac-12 both have Athletes United organizations who said, no, we want a seat at the table. It is not okay for you to make these decisions outside of including us. And what the groups that are the conferences at these tables would say, but we have an athlete representation mechanism. The problem is it is one or two athletes, and they're usually pushed off to the side when these kinds of decisions get made. And one of the things I argued in the article that you mentioned is it's time for the next 2 months, if you don't have football and the athletic directors don't have sports to oversee and the athletes aren't playing, they're just training, it is a perfect time to sit down and ask them, what does good medical care look like to you? What kinds of medical things should we be covering? Should we be offering lifetime insurance? Should we be covering graduate school in terms of education for you? What does racial justice look like to you? So it is a perfect window, a perfect moment to have the athletes and the people who run the Power Five, the big time program, sit down and say, okay, how can we make this so that this is more of a partnership rather than a dictatorship?
Something I heard Scott say when talking about student athletes saying they want to play and that you acknowledged earlier in this idea of they've worked so hard to be here, now we're saying you can't play, is that not only is it a will thing, but it's a future career thing. I mean, student athletes in college don't make money. They set themselves up to make money as athletes later on. Or even if they're not on the pro track, they're going to college on these scholarships that depend on them playing. How do we address that?
So fortunately, most of the conferences have come out, and the NCAA has also reinforced it, that nobody can lose their athletic scholarship if they choose to step away because they don't feel safe under COVID-19, they have a pre-existing condition, or if their programs decide not to compete, the athletes also won't lose their scholarships. Now, remember, football players do get full scholarships, but the other sports you mentioned get partials. So you might have one athlete who's on a scholarship of a full tuition and another who might only get room and board. So these amounts vary, and there's still a financial piece of this for the parents and the families. But there has been a rapid acceleration and recognition that the athletes need to have access to all the normal things that they would have should they be in season. So they need access to the training rooms. They need access to their coaches. They need access to their academic support staff. They need care if they get sick. So all of those things which weren't built into the conference or the NCAA rules are quickly being adapted in this scenario.
Talking with Karen Weaver, who's assistant clinical professor at Drexel University and also joining the faculty at the Graduate School at the University of Pennsylvania next month. And we're talking about the state of college athletic competition right now in a pandemic. And we're taking your calls. Nancy from Adams wants to join in. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. What are you thinking about?
Well, all the billions of dollars that the these universities, the Big Ten and the Pac-12, have in their endowment funds. And are they tapping into those to cover these expenses, or are they going to be just left sitting and they'll beg for more money added to the endowment funds?
Yeah, Nancy, thanks for that question. And Karen, you know, there are so many layers to college finances, but we do know that athletics bring in a lot of money.
They do, and they do a really good job of trying to endow, you know, coaching positions or athletic director positions or athletes like the quarterback or the wide receiver. But I actually took a look at what some of the sports endowment incomes were for various Big Ten schools. And remember, the endowments, there's the university endowment, and then there's the piece that's dedicated particularly to athletics. And those are two very separate things. So the most recent reporting shows that, for example, the University of Michigan, which we consider to be a highly successful, very visible program, gives back $6.5 million a year back into the athletics budget. Now, their athletics budget is well over $170, $180 million. So $6.5 million isn't a huge amount of money. Contrast that with the University of Iowa, which has $3 million in endowment income that goes back. Penn State has $6.5 million. But then the newest members of the Big Ten Conference, Rutgers only has $1.4 million that goes back into the athletic budget. Maryland has $1.1 million, and Nebraska did not report any, so we don't know what theirs is. So there's this wide range, even within the Big Ten, of how much they can rely on the endowment monies to supplement the athletic budget.
As we wrap up here, I want to talk about the potential for transfers, because there may be some students now in conferences that will not get to play, thinking about whether they can transfer to a school that is playing. I mean, is that a possibility, and how should we think about that?
It absolutely is a possibility. Now, whether there's room on the roster at the school you're looking at is another story. If they only keep three people at your position and you're number four, they may not be interested. But if you're a good quarterback and they needed a good quarterback, they might be very interested in having you. But here's the flip side. The flip side, and I'm speaking as a coach now, is you probably were recruiting that athlete from the time they were in ninth grade, maybe even earlier. So you have invested 3, 4, 5 years into your relationship with that athlete. And this is what unnerves coaches so much at this particular time, because they look at it going, because of this pandemic, I could lose this athlete because I understand why he wants to play. And so the idea of creating every possible opportunity to play in the spring becomes more and more important, because you want the players to stay with you and not leave, go chasing another opportunity somewhere else. It is a very tenuous time for the coach-athlete relationships on teams.
Karen, we really appreciate everything that you've gone over, and certainly this story is not done. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Karen Weaver is assistant clinical professor in the LeBeau College of Business at Drexel University, though next month she will be joining the faculty at the graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania. And we talked with her today about big changes to college sports, particularly the Big Ten and Pac-12, who've decided to postpone all sports for the fall, unlike the other three major conferences when it comes to college athletics. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. And weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. here on the Ideas Network, it's the morning show. Tomorrow, tune in for an update on the latest in sports. A Wisconsin sports journalist joins the program to talk about the latest as professional sports cope with COVID-19. And we're taking your calls, your questions, and observations. Join us tomorrow morning for that conversation and more here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we learn about some of the complex cultural and racial history behind diabetes in America. I'm Keely Boltina. This is Central Time.